It is Wednesday, September 17th. Welcome back to Damon Bruce Plus. As always, we're brought to you by Ike's Sandwiches. One of the single best things you're going to have to eat all week will be coming from Ike's. Trust me on that. Get yourself to Ike's Sandwiches. And if you're not in a delivery area, boy, I hope you are soon. I hope there's one opening up near you. Maybe it's time for you to move. Ike's has got something delicious for you. Thanks to him for being a sponsor. I would love to invite you to the Dubliner on West Portal in San Francisco on Saturday, October 4th at 4:20. We're going to be getting together for another Pluse Mania meetup. We'd love to have you there. If you are within driving distance of West Portal in San Francisco, we hope that you can join us again. A time that everyone can remember, 4:20 on October 4th is when we're going to be there. We're going to have a DJ spinning wax. We're not playing DATs. We're not playing CD. Wax, baby. Records is what we're going to be spinning. And it's going to be a really good time. Hopefully you can join us the Saturday after that Thursday nighter between the Rams and the 49ers. And when it comes to your Thursday nighters, your Monday nighters, and your Sundays, why not check out Sleeper, who we're very happy to have here as a sponsor of the Damon Bruce Show. And if you are going to be making some plays, you got to check out Sleeper. It's a great user interface, and I'm going to tell you right now, all you got to do is pick more or less. Touchdowns, passing yards, receiving yards, fantasy points. It's all there for you. You can 1,000x your cash on Sleeper. Make sure you use promo code Damon when you sign up. Click on the link in the description of this video, and that'll take you where you need to go. Sign up, Damon. Get your $100 first deposit bonus match, and it is great to have Sleeper aboard. Thanks very much. All right, now that we've got our business done, let me tell you, I was just telling today's guest. You see I'm wearing headphones. That means we have a guest. Today's guest is someone I've been trying to book on the show for like a month and a half now, but he's been busy and I've been busy and whatever we plan on, and he's away and I'm away, and we haven't been able to put it together till right now. And I was really happy because it sounds like he's really ready to go, because I got a DM from him saying, I've got 49ers thoughts. I said, that's great, because we got a lot of 49ers thoughts over here too. He is one of the best media members out there, and it's because he's kind of not even really in the media anymore. He does his own thing. His independence is his power. And he is the living sole heir of the Levi Strauss fortune. Until then, he's just going to keep on doing Substack until that money comes in. Thank you, Ethan, for joining us before that payday comes from the heavens.
I've lied to people about that before. I appreciate you helping me lie about it, that I'm a scion, that I'm an heir, that I'm playing polo on a yacht with my Levi's fortune while watching the 49ers game on that yacht and having my reactions where I go, which is very high-class reactions.
I want to see you on a yacht on a treadmill controlling a drone for a big pull-away shot like Magic Johnson did he was waving to all the poors back in the United States, wherever he was. Either way, Ethan, I mean it. It is really good to have you here. Your Substack has just been incredible. Hold on, I got a little glitch. There we go. Plug it in, as always. Mm-hmm. Your Substack has been incredible, man. You've been really on some, you know, great sports topics. Pablo Torre was an incredible interview that you just did. That guy is out there really representing journalism with a capital J in a world where that's becoming harder and harder to find. You dive into, you know, other topics that people who originate from the world of sports would never even think of handling. And as always, man, I really respect your work. Thanks for coming on in today. It's great to have you.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Very gracious introduction. And it's funny because I can try to project this whole journalism and thinking and the big issues, but like so many of the people watching, I reserve about 40% of my brain space this time of year on the Niners. That is what I'm doing. That's what I'm hiding from a lot of my own customers. I can't stop thinking about it, Damon. This team, this damn team, it just grabs you and has for a few years at least.
They're fascinating. I mean, if you're looking for why they're good, you can find a lot of things to point at. If you're looking for why things continue to go wrong, there's even more things to point at. They're, you know, whether they're walking at you or walking away from you, there's something to look at for sure. Through 2 weeks, what do you think of the 2-0 start? What do you think of Robert Saleh's return? And are you enjoying the Mac Jones era?
It's a great setup. Well, there's some bad news, good news, Damon. I think this has been an underplayed storyline right here. And it's that the NFC West might be too good. So the good news is, after all the injuries and everything that went wrong, you're 2-0 with a divisional win. The bad news is this is what the people who do the DVOA, you know, Aaron Schatz, they've got the statistical soup on how teams are good that takes out a lot of the noise. Don't ask me how they do it, but it seems like they do it well. Right now, looking at the DVOA rankings, you've got the Rams second. You've got the Seahawks sixth. You've got the Cardinals seventh. The Niners, I think, with a good showing at 13, considering all that's happened, but that's an uphill road. So we feel happy right now, but with the Cardinals game looming, that's the big worry, is that, man, the Niners, I think, have exceeded expectations in some ways, considering the hardship, but so too has the competition, Damon. It's worrisome.
Don't think of me as robbing you of your talking point as much as I want to alleviate your anxiety.
Okay.
Small sample size.
Yeah, yeah. Small sample.
I mean, I think DVOA will really start mattering once we get to week 8, week 10, and we really know what's what. Early on here, I'm really not too concerned about, you know, well, the yards per completion when he's throwing it is this, but when he's, it's like we've played 8 quarters of football. There's still an awful lot of season coming out there. And, you know, the way I see it is it is just tread water. Tread water through the beginning of the season, and for the first time maybe ever, the 49ers are going to have a mechanism available to them that is normally not available to them. How about health actually working in the 49ers' favor? Like, if they can keep their legs underneath them right now, get through this weekend with Mac Jones, maybe take on Jacksonville with Mac or Purdy, either way, my gosh, could you be 4-0 after 4 weeks given the start to this year? And then there's a world where Brock Purdy's coming back to the team and Brandon Ayuk's coming back to the team and your future Hall of Fame tight end, George Kittle's coming. When has health ever worked in the Niners' favor? When have they ever been healthier as the season went along? I can't find the example, so I'd like to see that actually happen for a change.
Yeah, it's tread water for long enough, and here comes the Coast Guard. And maybe not even the Coast Guard. Maybe it's Magic Johnson's yacht pulling up, and you actually have some comfort. And teams don't plan for this, but we've seen it work that way. Obviously, the sport I used to cover, every now and again, Steph Curry or back in the day, Kevin Durant, they would get injured at a point in the season where it didn't hurt them. It actually allowed those guys to rest and then come back at the exact right time. You don't plan on it. It's really hard. It's really hard to tread that water. But if they can do it and get to the other side, oh, here comes the cavalry. It's coming back. If they can get there, it's just all about getting there.
You know, I feel like when you were covering the NBA on a daily basis, the topic of load management and preventing injuries was coming into focus like never before. It certainly garnered attention like never before. When it comes to the Niners and all their injuries, Ethan, do you like prescribe any blame to the Niners themselves for what seems to happen to them at a higher rate than it happens in other NFL markets? I mean, I am sure they're very aware how their seasons have been dashed by injury and have done all they can to prevent them. They're not stupid. They're not, you know, I've seen stories like, well, the 49ers don't even stretch. Of course they do. Like, who are you reading? Of course they stretch. But do you prescribe any blame on the Niners for this injury situation that never really leaves them?
Yeah, I do, but it's with some admission of ignorance, because I don't know what they're doing wrong, but I know the results are not what they should be. And people have different views of injuries. Some people look at it all as luck. I don't. I look at it as the same thing in all of sports. Like when you work for a good shot in basketball, you did everything right. The shot should go in. You worked for a good shot. It didn't happen that time. It will happen over time. With the Niners, we have a long enough sample size, long enough track record where they're not getting the results they should get. These aren't freak injuries by and large. A lot of them are soft tissue. So I'm not an expert. I don't know exactly what they're doing. I assume the guys stretch. I think it's fair to say you're getting the worst results of any team. So something needs to change. A little like special teams, Damon. I don't know what they were doing wrong with special teams. I'm not a special teams expert. But I knew enough to look at what was happening last season to go, I think the special teams coach might have to go. You might got to bring somebody else in there. That's how I feel about the injuries.
As a 49ers fan, where are you on Kyle Shanahan? Granted, where you are today might not have been where you were in the early years of Shanahan. I think everyone's gone on a little bit of an evolution with the guy. where would you say your relationship is with Kyle Shanahan?
Yeah, where am I on the Lombardi to Grant Cohn scale? Where am I on that?
that needs to be it, by the way. No. I think that could be it. That's the scale.
The Lombardi to Grant Cohn. I think I'm a little bit in between, maybe a little bit more towards the Lombardi after that last game. I don't necessarily say this guy is the next Bill Walsh, but he's clearly good. He's got his blind spots. I'm frustrated by the unseriousness he's had towards special teams, because the great coaches deeply care about that.
Yeah.
Andy Reid deeply cares about it. Bill Belichick deeply cared about it, and they should. It's like 20% to 25% of the plays. You should care about special teams. So Kyle is a little bit of that. I like focusing on what I like to focus on, and that's what I like to focus on, and that's a frustration. But he clearly knows a tremendous amount about football. I would recommend Mike Silver's book about the Shanahan coaching tree. And that's also Big Daddy Shanahan, Mike Shanahan.
Right.
That book was some great, I say it not meaning actual propaganda, but it worked on me as propaganda. I came out feeling more positively about Kyle, but I don't feel the Lombardi scale of it. I do have my frustrations every now and again.
Best case scenario for this season, obviously, is winning the Super Bowl at home over anybody. You know, if you got an opponent like the Chiefs or Ravens, so you could have some revenge story attached to it, that would just be style points. But dream scenario is Kyle lifts Lombardi at Levi's this year. Mm. By the way, I have the worst case scenario.
No, it's a worst case scenario. Isn't another sad Kyle sitting in the locker room after a Super Bowl loss? That's not the worst case.
I do have it for you. So you know, you could say, what would you rather do? Lose a Super Bowl or bow out in the NFC title game? If this were to be the Super Bowl loss, it would be good for Kyle to bow out in the NFC title game, because what I don't think the man could ever go home with and sleep well with again is if he were to lose a third Super Bowl. This one at home, this one to the Chargers and Jim Harbaugh. Would that be the moment of like, hey, Kyle, we do think you're a good coach, but obviously there's no coming back from that. It's time to maybe just move on.
Ooh, I don't know. I'd take it is what I would say. I know it's easy for me to say now. That would be very painful.
You'd
remember
the Super Bowl loss to the Chargers at home right now and say, Kyle, we'll see you in 2026. No problem.
Yeah. Yeah, if he got this team there with all its deficiencies, and I just want to be in the mix. I want to follow the journey of the season. I value that. But I remember that last Super Bowl loss. My neighborhood felt it. And everybody, the people watching right now, did you do this as well? Because I find this fascinating right here. Everybody I knew who cared about the Niners was replaying different plays of that game and fantasizing that it went differently.
Yes.
That Nick Bosa guessed right on that quarterback keeper and hit Mahomes in the backfield. Just going with little different, changing the reality. I find that so interesting. It didn't matter. Everybody I was talking to, different backgrounds, people from different cultures. Everybody was doing that and changing what happened. And that's painful, Damon. It is really painful. And you know what? I still would want it over a 6-win season. I would still sign up for that. I would rather love and lose than just have a mediocre blah Chicago Bears of it.
Thanks. Having grown up a Bears fan, thanks. And by the way, you're right. I mean, you are so right. Believe me, you would rather live in the world that Niners fans insist could be unsurvivable at times than these other worlds with real unsurvivable, unfun fandom factors that are, you know, surrounding them at all times. When let's just say it's not a Super Bowl year, though. Not everything goes forever. At what point do you think a coach starts to lose a voice in the locker room? At what point is the return on Kyle Shanahan now no longer really easy to see? Do you think he's got 2, 3, 4 more years to get this done? Where is the expiration date on this? Is there an expiration date?
I think you don't make the playoffs 2 seasons in a row. I think that's what it comes down to. And you are detecting a little bit of impatience. And I'm just going by the people I read. There's some York impatience. It appears that Shanahan lost some power. And maybe that's for the good, by the way. Maybe that's good because it appeared that he almost is a bit of a GM. And I think those roles should be compartmentalized. I think that's something that Andy Reid has done well is I'm the coach. You're going to be the GM because the coach, you just don't have the bandwidth. You don't have the bandwidth. You're too close to it. You've got too many loyalties. So I think it's good that they've taken some of the power from him. I do, because if it's his fault to a degree that they paid that Ayuk contract, that's an indication that they needed to take some of the power. But their willingness to take some of the power, I do think signals a little bit of impatience. So I think it's a 2-year deal. I think it's missed the playoffs 2 years in a row. Time to go. That's what it's going to be.
How long are you going to let the Mac Jones wick burn without worrying about the candle going out here? He is the king of less is more. Very impressed with New Orleans in that performance. Yeah. Maybe that was because New Orleans isn't very good. I don't know. But that was nice. I'm going to tell you right now, I feel like that's the zenith. It can't really get better than that. The whole nonsense of like, is he going to displace Brock Purdy? I don't think there's a world where that exists, not based on the financial commitments they've made to Brock Purdy just 5 minutes ago. I think Mac Jones is good through the Jaguars game. After that, you are looking the gift horse directly in the mouth.
Yeah, I think with Mac Jones, I would say this. I don't have complaints, but I do have concerns. That's what I'm saying based on that game. I think he deserves a ton of credit. Him and Kyle both. They really, in an adverse scenario, I know the Saints stink, which is hard to say three times fast, but it was difficult. There are a lot of injured guys, and their game plan worked, but it was a very conservative game plan. And I got to give credit to Dieter Kurtenbach because he said, look, based on the film I've seen of Mac Jones watching the Jaguars and all that, she's just going to spam tight end throws and these throws in the flats. And I'm watching the game and you got a lot of throws going into that short area. A lot of Tongis, a lot of McCaffrey. And I think his longest completion was 16 yards past the line of scrimmage. I know he threw another bomb that was way off. And it's a weird thing with Mac Jones because he does have an arm, but it just doesn't seem like that's what he does. He doesn't sling it. So I looked at that and I went, I think it was smart of them to go that conservative. I think he did what he needed to do. And when it was 3rd and 14, he really stepped up and he made some big throws. But you know what it was, Damon, when I was watching it? You know what I thought about? In addition to the successful 2-minute drill that Mac Jones did, the whole game kind of felt like a 2-minute drill. And here's what I mean by that. A 2-minute drill where you have to score, where you can't give the ball up, so you've got four downs. What do? You get these little chunk plays. You see that great, that Super Bowl drive of Montana against the Bengals. There's no huge play. It's just doing your job, little chunk, little chunk, little chunk. And you can do that when you've got four downs, actually. You don't need to really sling it the same way. You just need to be consistent and limit mistakes. I think that can work against the Saints. If that's his approach, and there's not going to be really, I'm not going to go for any completions of over 20 yards, I don't think you can do that against the big boys. I don't think it's sustainable, is what I'm saying. I think they did a great job getting a game. They needed to get a game. He maybe could do better. But if this is the strategy, if this is the sort of Jimmy G-esque strategy, I don't think they have the defense to support that kind of approach long-term.
I think that so much of the NFL's offense operates in what I call like a 16-yard box. You got 12 yards beyond the line of scrimmage. You got 4 yards behind the line of scrimmage. And just about all the offense you see everywhere comes from somewhere in there. The downfield strikes, the shotgun, I'm throwing the big Dan Marino to Mark Duper, John Clay. Like it doesn't really happen around football that much anymore. It doesn't even happen in a scenario like Cincinnati where you think, oh man, this is just going to be Joe Burrow flipping it to Ja'Marr Chase 50 yards down the field over and over and over again. I don't think that football exists like that anymore. I just think defensive ends are crashing so hard. If you don't have that ball out in under 3 seconds, your play is probably going to be toast. So I hear you. There's an awful lot of can't go broke, taking a profit going on there. But I think that that's almost like mandatory requirement. Like, you must be this tall to ride this ride in the NFL right now. And I just think that football means fast more than ever before. It's fast. You know, if a play used to be 4 seconds, now it's 2.8 seconds.
Yeah.
And getting it out lightning quick is going to really prevent that. My man made it 30 yards downfield before I even let go of the ball. It's going to be harder to find.
I see that. And I think in a way Brock could maybe take a page out of Mac's book and do a little bit more of can't go broke, making a profit, and a little bit more of the check down. I think that, but I also think that's the difference between Brock and Mac Jones. He gets the ball out, Brock, that is, quick, but it's an anticipatory throw and it's going to go for 20 to 25 yards. I think in that Seahawks game, he might've had 3 or 4 of them, whereas Mac Jones has none. And that's one of the reasons why, if you look at the stat nerds again, the QBR, why even though that Brock performance against the Seahawks was more criticized than the Mac performance against the Saints, the QBR is significantly higher for Brock because those are valuable completions. They aren't easy. They aren't necessarily common. And hey, it's one game of Mac. Maybe he can do it. Maybe he can start throwing those anticipatory throws into the middle of the field, down the field. I don't know if that's his game. And so the Cardinals are going to be a test. And that's why I say, I don't have complaints. Job well done. You did exactly what I think you guys should have done in that game. You got the game well executed. I don't necessarily think it's sustainable. And if people are going, we've got a new quarterback, no more Brock, I would say it's a bit of an overreaction.
So I think you're going to have an element of this offense looking kind of like what it looks like, no matter who's playing, as long as you got Christian McCaffrey out there. That's how important McCaffrey is to everything this offense does. And defensively, Ethan, to me, the whole world is pretty much going to be fine and dandy as long as nothing happens to Fred Warner. I mean, Fred Warner is just, he's unbelievable. Sure, there's Nick Bosa, and sure, Diamador Lenore right now is off to an awesome start in that secondary. But to me, Fred Warner is the one non-negotiable. So and good. Christian McCaffrey, I think, is almost back there himself. I've said this with you in the past in interviews that we've done. There are two athletes in my lifetime who I knew were really good. You didn't have to explain it to me. I would agree with you, but I didn't really get it until they were in person in front of me all the time. One was Kevin Durant. I knew how good he was, but I didn't until I saw him every night. And then I realized, like, oh, there really is nothing quite like this dude anywhere. Christian McCaffrey is the same guy to me. I knew he was really good. I had no idea he was this good. I think he's one of the greatest football players that has ever lived. And right now, in just a small handful of games, is already like one of the greatest 49ers of all time.
I've got no counter argument there, but I do want to riff on the Fred Warner thing. I do want to riff on that. That was just spectacular. And what I love about Warner, he's so good in so many ways. He's so good in coverage, but there are defensive players who are reactive and there are defensive players who are proactive. Again, I think back to basketball. One of the things I loved about Draymond, yeah, he's reacting. You have to react on defense. But if a guy brings the ball in his midst, it's give me the ball. I'm taking the ball. I love that Fred Warner, it looks so easy when they show you in slow-mo, but the other guys don't do it. How he's mid-tackle, mid-air. Oh, and I'm going to punch it out too. I'm also going to punch it out too. I love that Fred Warner's mentality is the ball is the most valuable thing. Stopping you is cool. I don't want to just stop you. I want to take it from you. And his ability to do that repeatedly, and I think we got less of it last season because of the injury, but you saw it in that first game against the Jets, his ability to just get the ball with his hands. It's beautiful. It's just, he's an excellent player. I'm not breaking any news here, but man, was it cool to watch again with him actually healthy.
I think your Niners are about to have a good season. I think it's
my Niners.
Yeah, your Niners. I just covered the team. You are the 49er fan in this conversation. I just sit here and cover the team. But I tell you, I do like what I see out of them for 2 weeks. And I think that there's a scenario where they get better as the year goes along. They get healthier as the year goes along. This schedule says, please kiss me on both cheeks and win 12 games. It's going to be pretty easy as far as NFL schedules go. So nice start all the way around. I want to ask you about the other bit of a cause celeb topic around the NFL this week, and that's Tom Brady. His role as a broadcaster, his access to other teams and broadcast meetings, And then we just see him on Monday Night Football sitting in the Raiders coaching box wearing a headset, clearly
Doesn't work.
So look at it this way. It was an interesting 48 hours for Tom Brady. Yeah. He signs up to play flag football. He gets himself captured in the Raiders coaching box. Where is your level of, do you even expend any outrage? Will the NFL do anything about it? Or does Brady get to operate in a world of I'm Tom Brady, rules don't apply to me?
I have a take still on the Niners that I will get to later about Purdy. We're going to tease that for later. No, we don't do it now. I love this topic. I just want to table that. Put it on the mental PTI scroll.
49ers. I wrote it down.
I don't have outrage is what I would say about it, but I'm living the result of it not working. And what I mean by that is this. When you hear Tom Brady on broadcast, he's not very good. He's not very good. He should be great. In interviews, he's often great. In this kind of old man, angry at this new generation, I think there's authenticity to it. I like it. But he's in this position where he's a part owner and he's calling the games and he's compromised and he feels like he can't really say certain things. And you feel it when you listen. When I'm listening to Greg Olson, I'm just listening to a guy broadcast. When I'm listening to the lead broadcaster of Fox, Tom Brady, I'm listening to a guy who's almost afraid that he's going to alert the feds to his scam, that he's a member of the Raiders and part of their ownership and has access to intel because of it. And yet he's supposed to announce the games. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. So I'm not calling for any sort of significant punishment. I'm just saying that as a viewer, as somebody who loves Fox NFL, loves the theme song. I'd say that's the best of the theme songs. I don't really love Tom Brady on broadcast. And I suspect that I would if he wasn't trying to have his cake and eat it too and own a team while being the objective, impartial announcer on these games we're watching.
Speaking of cake, how much cake does it take to get Tom Brady to come play flag football in Saudi Arabia? Is that a 9-figure check that they've written to him? Do you think he's making $100 million off of his flag football dalliance, era of flag football?
I mean, he lost a lot in that FTX scam. It might take a little less money than you might think. You might be able to get Tom Brady on Cameo saying happy birthday. That guy, a divorce, getting scammed by SBF. I don't know. He might be open for anything. There's a reason the man is trying to be an owner while collecting these $20+ million checks to announce the games. I think he needs it wherever he can get it.
Honey, Tom Brady's working bar mitzvahs. Give him a call.
He'd be open.
Okay, a call. I did not mean to rob you of your 49ers platform and take, Ethan. The floor is yours.
Yeah, I just want to speak counter to something I'm hearing out there because I think that we've been misled by a lot of the sports media on a topic. And I understand why. I don't think it's nefarious. I just think it's a little complicated. And what I'm seeing a little bit in the 49ers content creator community, a little bit in the national NFL media, some people I like, but I disagree with. You've had Nick Wright on. You argued Purdy with him. It's this idea that the Niners are spending all this money on Purdy and that you got a good performance from Mac Jones means that you screwed up. You know, I'm seeing Grant Cohn, God love him, saying that I'm saying they shouldn't be spending $53 million on Brock Purdy. That's a bad decision. They should be spending that money elsewhere. I think what's been underplayed and underrated is that the 49ers actually aren't spending that much money in terms of the cap on Brock Purdy. And I think it's been underrated because so much of the narrative was you're going to go from paying this guy nothing to cashing him out. The salad days are over. Your flexibility is gone. You've been living high on the hog. And what's been underplayed is that the cheapness of his contract, again, this is complicated just a little bit. Stay with me, people. Stay with me. The cheapness of his old contract is the gift that keeps on giving. Because he's getting paid nothing this season, they were able to front load the deal and put the massive signing bonus and stash it there. And he's going to account for less than 10% of the salary cap. So this idea that this was some terrible decision, you've got over 90% of your salary cap for a few years. If you can't build a good team around that, that's a John Lynch problem. that's not a scenario. I mean, you look at, I'm just looking this up. Obviously, Dak Prescott is the example of paying way too much, but you're looking at, here are the cap hits, not how much cash you're paying him, but this is how much of the cap is getting absorbed. With Purdy this year, 9.1 million, 24.8, 30.8, when the salary cap is going to be a lot more. Dak, 53 million, projected 76.5 million, and then 68 million. I know Dak is the highest paid, but I'm just giving you an example. This is still a cheap deal. This is still highly affordable. And I think a lot of the narrative on it is wrong. And instead of going, oh my God, they really have figured out how to finagle this in a way where they've got a lot of flexibility, the narrative is totally backwards. And it's, oh my God, they're so hamstrung. And just from the perspective of somebody who covered the NBA, I think it's a media malpractice, Damon. I don't want to be too extreme about it, but it's a media malpractice not to explain it to people and to just overemphasize, oh my God, they're in debt. They're so constrained. They're not. It's the opposite. So that's what I'm saying.
For the NFL to be widely no second place, most consumed, most passionately followed sports entity in the world, the understanding of it is still hard to find in an awful lot of the fans who claim to love it so much. And that's just in terms of what we're looking at on a football field. When you get into the financials, now the misunderstanding is prolific. And the way that fans attach their fan emotions to team spreadsheets as much as on-field results is something I've never understood about. If I can put something on the table to you that drives me nuts, is the anger over dead cap space. If these teams don't care about it, why should I? This is just, it's literally rollover accounting is what you're getting upset about. Dead cap space is a reality that these teams have decided to live comfortably in order to continue doing brisk business in the future. It's not preventing anything from happening. As you just said, Brock's dollar amount is not preventing a good team from being built around him in any way, shape, or form. And there is a misunderstanding. I think it's because we finally found the thing, Ethan. And by the way, I told Ethan before our show started today that our discussion was broken up into four topics, basically. Football, basketball, and then, well, no, three topics, and then discourse, basically. Maybe this goes more towards discourse, but we finally found the thing that sells more than sex. Sex sells. Outrage.
Outrage. I thought you were going to say jealousy, but yeah, that too.
Outrage sells more than sex. So I think anytime people looking to garner attention can attach outrage to the point they're making, whether it should come with a serving of outrage or not, it's put there because people respond to it and then they carry it and they go with it. There is nothing outrageous about Brock's contract as it exists right now. It is completely devoid of sticker shock when you look at who he is, what he's done, and where he's being paid in the hierarchy of quarterbacks right now. There should be no shock or anger attached to his salary at all.
That's where I'm at with it. And look, if you say it's disappointing he's hurt right now, I would say yeah, but I would say that they've mitigated a lot of it by how they've structured it. And again, it's a little bit complicated. The reason is because they're basically paying him nothing this season, and they signed the new deal. They were able to sock away the money and slide it onto a season in which he's making no money. You can't do that in the NBA. When Jokic went from making $1.5 million as a second rounder to getting this big rookie extension, you couldn't take the first year of that lavish rookie extension and slide it into the year when you were paying him nothing. But you can do that in the NFL, and that smooths it. And so it's this interesting story of his historically great deal, his historically cheap deal is the gift that keeps on giving. Because he was paid cheaply, it's still almost like he's going to be paid cheaply. And that's weird. It's totally the opposite of the outrage narrative that you're talking about, which is this guy's going to get paid so much money. You're going to be so mad when he's underperforming. Get ready to be mad. That's not the reality. The reality is you might not like him. The reality is you might say that he's injury prone, and that's a problem. The salary, you're not going to do better than the salary. You're just not for a starting quarterback. Geno Smith makes less money than Brock and accounts for more of the Raiders' salary cap. If you replace Brock Purdy for anybody long-term you'd be comfortable with, you will be more constrained with the salary cap than you are now. That's the reality right now. That's not what's told the fans. What's told the fans is the opposite. It's that the Niners are almost, I don't know, paying their quarterback more than anybody else is what it feels like.
Again, two thumbnails. One says 49ers reality. The other says 49ers outrage. I know what's going to get clicked on faster, and I think you do too. Our man Ethan Sherwood Strauss, he's dropped the shirt. When was the Sherwood officially eliminated, by the way?
It was too much. It was like in Social Network where Justin Timberlake says, drop the, it's cleaner. On Facebook. There
it
you go.
It is cleaner. It is cleaner. Okay. I'm going to tell you right now, Ethan used to cover the NBA. He no longer covers the NBA. Do not aggregate him based on the answers he's about to give. But I got to ask you about what's going on with the Warriors here, Ethan. We're getting so close to basketball season, and the Warriors only have 9 guys, I believe, on their roster right now. And they have allowed a Jonathan Kuminga situation to so gum up the works that they can't do business with other NBA players to round out their roster. It really is kind of unique in modern NBA negotiations, and the staggering stagnation on the Kuminga situation, it's something else. I mean, not knowing what to do with him has been the central defining feature of his relationship with the Warriors, and it remains. How does this come to an end?
That one, hard to answer, but I can answer what some of the dynamics are going into some of the problems. For people who don't know and follow the NBA casually, the NBA salaries have exploded. They've exploded, and it's created, because of the new structure, it's created a haves and have-nots. And so I was talking to somebody, not sure I should really say who I was talking to. Let's say somebody in ownership of a team. Okay, that's what I will say.
Okay.
I went to NBA Summer League and I said, look, this big money, is it screwing these players up? I know that that's a little bit taboo. You're not supposed to say that in media. You're not supposed to say that maybe a young man can get too much too soon. For whatever reason, there's this big fight against it. The agents hate it. You're not supposed to say it. And the guy said, actually, no, it's not screwing them up. The too much money too soon is not screwing them up. It's screwing up the guys who don't get the bag. That's who it's screwing up. These players, these young players, when they're looking at the rookie extensions and they see a guy, whatever they think of him, Wagner, whoever, and they go, I think I'm as good as that guy. I'm going to get 1/5 what he's getting. I'm going to get 1/6 what he's getting. The new salary structure in the NBA is really messing with these guys who are looking at it in terms of status and thinking, I deserve this. I'm this good. And that's why they're getting in these fights with these teams. And I think that's the case with Kuminga. And it's frustrating. It's so frustrating because if you had signed an extension with the Warriors when it ended, you would have been, I don't know, in your mid-20s. And if you're really great, you're going to get paid. The salary cap's going to get higher. So what is this whole protracted fight with the organization about? It just seems like putting the cart behind the head of the horse, whatever the term is. Penny wise, pound foolish. Horse,
and they're around each other. We know that.
There's a horse. Yeah, there's something like that. But yeah, you know, here's a stat. I might quote it wrong. I'm trying to think about it. Over 90% of the salary Steph Curry has earned in the NBA has come after season number 8. Okay. I'm going to say that again. Over 90% of what he's earned in the NBA came to him after his 8th season. He's an unusual case because he signed an affordable rookie extension, but man, that didn't kill him, Damon. That didn't cripple him financially. It's easy for me to say from the outside, but I look at this and I see these players. I go,
you'll never see an MVP making $11 million again. That's for sure.
You will not see it. But I'm saying, look, if you're getting an extension and you're making 10, 11, 12 million, something Kuminga could have gotten for himself, you're not going to the poorhouse. You're going to get a new opportunity. So I just think some of these players, they get so caught up in the status that they're trying to get every nickel out of the teams. And the teams are looking at these guys and they're going, dude, it's a new reality. We've got this thing called a salary cap now. Adam Silver did it. It's different. There's a reason Steve Ballmer is coming up with creative ways to incentivize players
we'll
to play
there.
For the Clippers.
We'll get there.
we don't have it. So Kuminga's demanding it. And I think the Warriors are going, dude, we can't do it. And I just think some of these guys are getting caught up in the status war that they're not, they don't believe the teams, and the teams say that we don't have it because the NBA used not to have a salary cap, and now they do.
Even Joe Lacob's harshest critic would have to admit he is one of the five greatest owners in the history of Bay Area sport. I mean, there's just no denying that Joe has done more good for the Warriors as an organization than he could ever do bad. But it does feel like we're officially entering the Joe Lacob might have his hand a little bit too much on the switch portion of his ownership here with the Warriors. And is he the right guy to lay down Steph Curry's career with as much dignity as possible? Are you worried about Joe and Kirk Lacob and the decisions that they've made? Is this a problem now for the Warriors? He's too involved.
I don't think I'm that harshly critical. I might be more of the Lombardi scale than the Cohen scale for the basketball version. I think they had a few swings in the draft that didn't work out, but I'm sympathetic to how it happened. Drafting guys in 2020 and 2021 was not easy. You look at Trey Lance in football. This was not a time where we got a lot of information about players. It was the pandemic. They weren't playing games. So I have sympathy, but those draft misses hurt, and they hurt for the Warriors, the Wiseman, and now Kuminga, who is a very talented player. But if I have to look at his career, I'm more of a seller than a buyer. And I say I'm more of a seller with the admission that there's a 20% chance he could pop and become an all-star and make me regret everything. But he doesn't play with the team. He doesn't expend nearly enough effort on defense considering his talents on that end. He doesn't like to pass. And I know for a fact that a lot of the coaches I've talked to who are with the Warriors who went on, who I see at Summer League. Uh-oh. Starting to sound like a cover the NBA, Damon. I got to be careful. I mean, I'm just a guy watching TV.
You're going to get aggregated, Ethan. You're just asking for it.
Oh, yeah. Let's say not the easiest guy to work with. Not the easiest guy to work with. And if I am going to have a criticism.
It's one of the things, you know, it's funny. I can tell when something is intended to get to me with a piece of information that they want me to then deliver on my show. It's funny. Even though I don't have the platform that I used to have, I feel the flow of information still coming to me, and it makes me go, oh, I guess I still do matter in this market, I guess.
They're more comfortable talking to us because we're not going to break the news of it. I think that happens as well.
Maybe, but I have been told by several people that Jonathan Kuminga, good guy, everyone likes him. Not easy.
Not necessarily about the team. And I think this is reflected in the whole battle. He doesn't want to. Here's the thing, too. I might be more critical if Patrick McCaw turned into a superstar, if Eric Paschal turned into an all-star. There have been a lot of these young players where we've looked and we've said, hey, Steve Kerr, what are you doing? Why aren't you giving them more tick? And if any of these guys went somewhere else and truly flourished, I might be more open to questioning Steve. But I think at this point, if you're gambling, you should think what you see is what you get. And if you are criticizing the Lacob side of this, maybe there's a little bit, maybe ownership's a little too enamored in the physicality and the talent of a Kuminga. And they should, it's almost the flip side of the Shanahan thing. Maybe the op side should listen a little bit more to the coaching side to get a more accurate read on the situation. And I would favor cutting bait. I would favor divorce. And I say that knowing full well, I could be wrong. He could be great. And if I'm wrong, ladies and gentlemen, I'll make an excuse and chalk it up to how I'm not covering the team anymore. I'm just a guy on the couch.
Does this situation stain Steve Kerr's position with this team?
I don't think it should. I don't think the team sees that. I think the op side understands the Kuminga difficulties. I think they see a lot of things a little bit the way Steve does. It's just Joe loves big athletic players. He always has. That was his vision of the team. That was Bob Myers' vision of the team. And they just happened to get stuck with this guy named Steph Curry, who happened to be one of the greatest players ever. And so they had to move with it. But their whole vision was just big, powerful, athletic. That's how they saw Harrison Barnes, for instance. He's a little bit behind getting Festus Ezeli. Now I'm going deep in the bag, but I think that they are a little bit frustrated.
JaVale McGee, anybody? Are you ready for JaVale McGee?
JaVale McGee was another example of how now I'm a little worried about revealing some things. I will say that Steve Kerr would get frustrated on occasion by fan sentiment as regards to one JaVale McGee. And this is a good example of how coaches know things that they don't tell us. And there's a reason they're not doing what we want them to do. With JaVale, he had asthma. He had asthma. He had only so much stamina out there.
Right.
And so remember, they would do that high pick and roll and he's dunking all over the place. And so people are sending Steve Kerr these emails going, more JaVale McGee. What the hell? More JaVale McGee, more pick and roll. And Steve, to us media people in more private moments, is going, they don't understand. A little like the Mac Jones thing. This is great. It's not sustainable. We can give JaVale maybe 12 minutes. We can't do it the entire time.
You're going to love 12 minutes of McGee. You're not going to like 22 minutes.
Yeah, less is more. And so I'm not saying Steve is perfect, but I think he has enough of a track record where I implicitly trust his choices. And I think he's not been given Kuminga the run because Kuminga shouldn't be afforded that run in the context of a team trying to do stuff. And I actually think that's not a war between him and ownership. I think ownership understands that to a degree. I think Lacob is just has ambitions for Kuminga. I think that's the scenario right now.
Do you think the Warriors are still a contending franchise?
Possibly. I think if a bunch of things went right last playoffs, if Jimmy Butler doesn't get hurt, if Steph Curry doesn't get hurt, it's possible. But it's possible in the way that recovering an onside kick is possible in the NFL. If you have an onside kick, it's not the expected outcome. I appreciate what we still have left. I appreciate that Steph Curry is still playing for them. I appreciate that they made the Jimmy Butler trade. I think that was a good trade. And I enjoyed what it gave us. It gave us a good series of playoff basketball that they won. But it's hard to see a way out of it. Things come to an end. And I don't know sometimes if we're more angry at the Warriors or we're just more angry that it's coming to an end.
I think, yeah, that's a very good point, by the way. No one wants the best show that they've ever seen to come to a close. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. Would you prescribe any, you know, like, oh, that's a good idea, to kicking the can of competition down the road this season for the maybe that could be Giannis in the offseason?
I just don't know how possible that is. I mean, yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean,
but here's the thing. Giannis is not Luka. Giannis is not some young man who's got like 14 years of really good basketball still in front of him. He is on the Steph Curry timeline more than he's on that Luka timeline. So this whole like, oh yeah, we're going to get our star to, you know, thrive with in the post Steph era. I don't know if that's the guy. Giannis is the present, not the future.
Yeah, I mean, look, if there's any shot at it, he's still so great and would fit so well that I'd be open to it. But they have to know, based on the back channel conversations, relationships, they have to know what their actual odds are. They knew Durant was coming long before Durant arrived, for instance. If you know, then sure. I just don't know if Giannis is ever going to pull the trigger like that. I think Giannis likes to flirt with leaving Milwaukee, and there's just been so much reporting out of that over so many years. But ultimately, it just hasn't happened, so I wouldn't hold my breath. But hell, if there's a chance of that, sure, do anything. Do anything for that chance.
Have the Valkyries captured your imagination in any way?
They haven't captured my imagination, but I'm intrigued by how much success the Warriors have had with them. And talking to people with the Warriors, their perspective on it is, hey, we're making money off this because nobody else has even tried. So that's why the Valkyries have been profitable. There are other reasons, but it's that the WNBA is a very weird business. It's this business that exists under the umbrella of the NBA as a subsidiary. And a lot of the people running these teams, they've got their NBA team, and this is almost like a nonprofit they donate to. So it kind of runs on autopilot. They don't actually do anything with it. And so the Valkyries are an interesting business story to me. I'd be lying if I said I'm watching the Valkyries every night. I'm not. I just find it interesting that the Warriors are making bank off of them.
Yeah.
And maybe we can worry in the way we worry about the Niners getting distracted by their soccer team out there. Is there a little too much Valks absorbing the attention and bandwidth and not enough of a look at Steph Curry's closing career? I don't know.
Yeah, look, I mean, women's basketball is just not for me. And in the Bay Area, you're allowed to be and believe whatever you like or do whatever you want.
The vibe shift has happened. You're allowed to admit that, David. You wouldn't, you wouldn't be allowed to a few years ago. Now you can say it without judgment.
Here's the thing. I did, and they didn't like that, but now I can say it maybe with less judgment. All I can tell you is that it's really not for me, but I will say this right now. Congratulations to the Valkyries. They're fans. My wife went to a game. She said it was an awful lot of fun. I asked her, what'd you see on the court? She's like, oh, well, we hardly paid attention. I'm like, well, that's part of it. But there's brisk business being done around them. Their $500 million valuation is the biggest funny money pile of nonsense you'll ever see. The Valkyries on their own are not worth $500 million. Without Chase Center being a part of them, they're not worth $500 million. And I would also suggest that if they were truly worth $500 million, it would be the Laver Cup moving to San Jose, not them for the playoffs. Hmm. But congratulations. I mean, outside of the Golden Knights, I don't think I've seen a better debut, hey, we're a playoff entity in our first year of existence than they. I mean, it is impressive. Even though I'm not watching, I'm impressed by their success in business, and they must have had some, you know, defense-first coaching in order to do this out of the town. I really don't know.
The Warriors' perspective is low-hanging fruit. Like, nobody's really tried to moneyball the WNBA. They just have sort of let the WNBA trundle along. So the Warriors looked at it, wait, we're taking this seriously. We're running this team. We're putting resources behind it. We care. And that is an interesting story. People don't want to admit that it hasn't happened elsewhere. I think there's a weird kind of doublethink with a lot of the media narrative, a lot of the sports media narrative on the WNBA, which is that it's doing great. It's doing gangbusters, and it's always been doing great. It's like, wait, come on. If you have the rise, you have to have where it was. And there's a lack of honesty about this league was just basically a tax write-off for a quarter century that almost nobody paid attention to. And now we can tell the story and have these debates about whether it can withstand Caitlin Clark being injured.
We're about to really get some Clarkless data back from this postseason compared to what we saw last year, and it will be interesting. By the way, a couple supers coming in here from Fuji Simeon is saying, I'm catching up on Molly leaving ESPN's First Take. Well, I will get there with Ethan, so stay with us here. He's also, Fuji, saying Valkyrie valuation $500 million makes Joe very happy. Oh, there's no doubt. It's been a nice investment, but no team is worth anything unless you're selling it for that. And I don't know anyone who's coming in and buying the Valkyries for $500 million, but you know, congrats. To me, though, it is a little
Kawhi Leonard's going to buy the Valkyries with all this money we didn't know he had.
The nonsense plant service is going to buy the Valkyries. getting tossed out of their own building though for the playoffs. Now, apparently, the Laver Cup booked out Chase Center when Caitlin Clark was still at Iowa. Like they have booked this date, and they did it like 4 years ago. But at the same time, no matter what the money, if they were really worth $500 million, I think Joe Lacob would have told the Laver Cup, sorry, we're getting out of this contract. We just have a, because they're only dating tennis. They're married to the Valkyries. You treat your wife better than this. You don't send her out of the home for the night.
Do you know, by the way, why the Chase Center exists? I've told this story before. I just find it so funny.
Because Kevin Durant said, build me a building that I'll never play in as a home. Why does it exist?
So the Warriors were having a hell of a time.
Your own money.
They were having a hell of a time building an arena in San Francisco. There's no good land in San Francisco that you're allowed to have. Right. It's impossible. They tried this.
I remember the Pier 38. We're gonna spend $1 billion on just pounding pylons into the bay before we even build the building. No, you're not.
They wanted to do that because Ellison failed when he was trying to move the America's Cup there. So that got their competition juices flowing. But of course it was impossible. They're boxed in. There's no way to do it. It's impossible. There's no land to do it with. They're stuck. What are they going to do? One day, Mark Benioff, the Salesforce tycoon, calls them up and says, I have all this land in Mission Bay and I don't need it. The Salesforce stuff has exploded so much in downtown San Francisco that I'll sell it to you at a good rate.
Right. I'm building a skyscraper.
What a miracle. I ran into Mark Benioff. I say ran in as though he knows me. He doesn't. I was just a reporter covering the beginning of Chase Center and the opening of it. And I come up to him and I ask, well, why did you do that? You really saved these guys. You had all this land around Mission Bay. Why did you do it? Why did you give the Warriors their billion-dollar arena? And he shrugs his shoulders and he says to me, Damon, this is what he says. I got tired of schlepping down to San Jose to see Elton John. That's why I did it. That's the main reason why I did it. That's why the Warriors have an arena in San Francisco, ladies and gentlemen. That's why. It's because a boomer wanted to see Elton John and was sick of going to San Jose to do it. That is what he told me. I don't think he was kidding. That's why they have it. That's why they have that arena.
I really wish Benioff were a bigger 49ers fan and didn't want to drive to Santa Clara.
Yeah. That would have been nice. That was nice.
Would have been nice. But it is, to me, it is kind of amazing that they didn't tell the Laver Cup to hit the bricks. And if you know what, if that comes with a $50 million lawsuit, that's fine because the Valkyries are worth $500 million. $50 million, that's just the price of doing business around my $500 million WNBA team. Interesting to say the least. I'm not trying to pull a fire alarm when they're saying there really isn't one. Everyone seems to be happy. We'll see if Balhalla, which, by the way, I do appreciate. That is a great nickname. That's a great nickname. Let's see if it can go on the road and get the ladies a win. We've officially reached the discourse portion of the show, Ethan.
And okay.
I got to tell you, this is, I think, maybe one of the topics you are best at tackling because you ask for no quarter, nor do you give no quarter to your former employer, ESPN. You've been hypercritical of your exit, how they go about their business, how they go about ruining successful businesses with their business at times as well. You've been a vocal critic of modern sports media, of groupthink, of herd mentality, and all that stuff. I want to get to Stephen A. Smith, who we learned today is like a $40 million a year entity. And congratulations to him. Make all the money in the world you can for a guy who himself isn't a former professional athlete, just talks. Amazing what he built. What I don't understand is why ESPN sees the value in him. Isn't the real value of Stephen A. Smith not what he does and what he says, but the platform that they have to project him from? Isn't the value the platform more than the guy? In which case, why not, instead of paying Stephen A. Smith $40 million, why not have four $10 million talents that you are offering up for different points of view? It's amazing how he has cornered their entire market.
This might be unfair because I don't know everything that goes into their strategy, but ESPN in the modern media ecosystem often strikes me as a guy who's swinging at a pitch that's already in the glove. It's too late. They want to get in on a trend. They want to get all in on gambling after the gambling gold rush. It's too late. You got to it late. They want to get in on these multimedia personalities. The idea, I think, isn't just that Stephen A. Smith is the host of First Take, but he's also somebody who's on YouTube and he's got a podcast and this and that. And that already happened. I think Shannon Sharp capitalized on that. And they brought in Shannon Sharp, not building with him as he did it, which Fox did, but afterwards. And then some other things happened with Shannon Sharp that, let's just say, complicated things. It just seems like it's too late.
She'd be thicker. I got to be honest. Go ahead.
I mean, boy. So, yeah, it just seems like it's too late. I can't really give you a good explanation of the idea of it other than it's just a straight. And you see this in other ways where they're paying an influencer all this money to just go to games and post on Instagram because that seems like the next wave. I don't know what they're doing. It's hard, Damon, because I don't want to be judgmental, but I also just don't see much sense in it beyond that Stephen A. Smith is one of the rare famous people who talk about sports, right? And it's a signal perhaps that cuts against the noise. He's one of the hardest working men in entertainment. That's true.
He clocks hours. There's no doubt. He puts in man hours.
Yeah, it's true. But just for a long time, it just feels like he's been their spackle, where whenever they have a hole or a problem, just rub some Stephen A. Smith on it. And it doesn't make sense in a lot of contexts. And this seems to be maybe an overextension of SAS. No offense to him. No disrespect, as he says.
Yeah. In a conversation about modern messaging in any way, whether it be journalism or just freaking birthday invitations. Substance, noise.
Yeah.
I would say that you, your Substack, you represent the concept of substance. So let me ask you, how is substance doing in its battle against noise these days?
I haven't really thought about that. I don't even know if I'm substance. I just like to talk.
How about this? I consume a lot of bullshit. You ain't bullshit, Ethan.
I'm honest. I would say I'm honest. Yeah. Now, is that substantive? I don't know. I don't know if it's as substantive as, say, what Pablo Torre has done recently. When you find real information, damning information, I mean, that's the greatest thing that there is. I think something that Pablo has revealed is that substance matters. It's just nobody believes in it. That's what I would say about it. I would say that Pablo is demonstrating that if you can do original reporting and fold that into an entertaining story, because we all love stories. It wouldn't be good enough, frankly, if Pablo just said, here's the documents, and he tweeted out the aspiration documents. No, what makes it pop is that he did these great episodes with my friend Amin El Hassan, with David Sampson, who I don't know, but is almost unintentionally hilarious and financially minded. And it hits. It hits. And so I think that's inspiring. Unfortunately, to really raise above the fray, you've got to do something incredible. That's the sad part. It's like being told that you can be healthy, but you've got to actually exercise and eat right. But I think that's a demonstration that we don't have to just assume everybody's an idiot. We know outrage sells, you said it before, but we don't have to assume that's the only way to get an audience. There are other ways to get an audience. I think the main problem is that a lot of the major media companies that still exist, like ESPN, just think we're total idiots, just think all we want is noise, and are doing almost an informational version of get rich quick, of just trying to grab us without giving us any reason to stick around. I think that's the problem.
You know, you're not trying to dunk on anyone when you make a point. You're just trying to deliver a better understanding. I think that that's a big lacking. It's a muscle that not a lot of people have anymore. Like, I'm going to have a conversation with someone who thinks differently than me, not to dunk on them, not to teach them a lesson, but to gain their perspective and to have that affect my perspective. Maybe I'll learn something from them. Maybe they'll learn something from me. And even as basic and simple as that sounds, it feels like an impossibility in so many of the conversations that we see. You know, I mean, this is from us talking about bullpens all the way to Charlie Kirk. I mean, it's the disc. We have forgotten how to talk to people who differ from us. And I think that is the single biggest missing ingredient in a functioning, healthy society. And again, with social media being the ultimate amplifier and anger machine, how do we ever get it back in the box? How do we just get talking to people again?
I'm not smart enough to figure that one out, but I do appreciate what you said. I don't like dunking on people. I think part of it is that I just have my own aversion. I got a weak stomach, or if we're talking about dunking, maybe I've just got a sprained wrist. I don't feel comfortable doing it. So when we have this conversation right now, I'm trying my best to see it from somebody else's perspective. I'm trying to see it from the Laker perspective. If Kuminga's seeing it wrong, I'm trying to at least assess it and come up with a reason for why a young man might be seeing it wrong, might be getting caught up in the status. That might be part of it. I don't really like when people demonize and villainize other people, because very few, if any, people wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and go, yep, I'm a big old fraud and I want bad things to happen and I'm a bad guy. That's not typically how it works. So you might not like something or somebody and not like what they're about, but I at least want to understand what they think they're doing. And what I do at my site, I just try to be passionately dispassionate in that way. I like to try to describe, here's what's going on. Here's why it's going on. I don't like this person, but I'll also acknowledge some good things about them, or at least some core competencies. For some reason, Damon, we've gotten into this mode where when a public figure is hated, there's this urge to tear them down and act like there's no reason that they even got public in the first place. And I just, the first time I noticed that was actually, I was at Salon, I was at Salon Magazine way back in the day when internet magazines were more of a thing. It was more of a progressive magazine. This is maybe around 2010, 2011. And Adam Carolla had said some things about women or whatever. And all my coworkers were just talking to each other about this guy is a total idiot. And just, you know, just he's just a total idiot and he's not funny at all. And the whole time I'm just secretly thinking, I listen to Loveline. I think Adam Carolla is kind of funny. I think he's like a funny guy. Yeah. You might not like him. You might not like this guy, but why can't we just even acknowledge something good about somebody we don't like? Everybody right now just seems like a PR person for whatever cause or message they're trying to advance. I don't like it. I don't like that approach. I want to, even when I really don't like somebody, even when it's somebody like Woj, who I think had a negative impact all on my career. No, I'd say he'd have a positive impact on my career by getting me fired from ESPN, but take me out of it. A negative impact on ESPN's NBA coverage. Woj is a human being and he's got great qualities and he's got a lot of warmth for the people who are in his circle. I want to portray all of it. I might be rambling. I apologize to the people in the chat, but Damon struck something in me. I just wanted to talk about all that.
No, I love it, man. And you know, your situation with Adrian Wojnarowski was very unique. Very unique.
Weird.
It was very weird too, because I always thought him a person of substance, and he would see a person of substance in you and look to amplify what you were doing, not looking to retard what you were doing, but it was the opposite.
Well, according to him, it wasn't. According to him, he had nothing to do with firing me. And he said nice things to me. He said things like that to me. And after I got fired, he called me up and he said that he had nothing to do with it. But if I'm totally honest, I didn't really believe that. But I don't know. It's a strange thing. I didn't know we were going to go down that whole road of it.
I wasn't even thinking
I've
about
got,
it.
I opened the door. I've got no resentments about it. I think that even if somebody did you wrong in the past, if you are mad at them, it's almost like admitting that you don't like where you're at, and you should like where you're at. You're lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to be in media. I'm lucky to be making a decent living just being a forever teenager talking about Mac Jones and whatever else. So I've got no real resentments, but I'm in the role, Damon, with what I do, where I'm just going to describe it honestly. And if I think, honestly, this is the issue with ESPN, or this former colleague of mine is doing something I don't like, I'll try to gently point it out in an honest way without dunking.
Let's wrap up with this. Where does true power come from? A network's ability to amplify a message to go further than it would without that company doing it, or having the independence that you now have since you are your own boss and you serve no masters as you do your podcast and your Substack. Where does the true power lie? In the independent, thoughtful message or in the amplification of bullshit?
I think you're leading the witness a little bit right there. I think there's a lot of power in being independent, and there's just a lot of power in people who are even with these big institutions who are independent. I don't look at Pat McAfee as any sort of, I don't know, thinker or philosopher, no offense to him, but every now and again, you know, pardon my language right here, he'll say fuck you to his bosses, and that gives him a tremendous amount of power, that he has both. That he's amplified by them and he's on game day and he's got his own thing and he shows a willingness to leave. That's some serious power. But I think what's happened in sports talk, if we're just bringing it back to sports, is that there were corrupting conflicts of interest that weren't acknowledged that seeped into the analysis. I think one of the reasons why 49ers YouTube, to take it to a weird place, has been so successful is you guys will be honest about players. You'll be negative. What happened in media, especially with the NBA, is that the major entities like ESPN got obsessed with breaking news. How do you break news? You break news through agents feeding you the new trade, the new contract. So everybody just got really hearing footsteps, not being honest, not talking about the game itself. And I think that's one of the reasons why independence has won the day. I think it's because the people in power, the people with big companies, had these conflicts of interest and were bullshitting people. And that's why you find more honesty on YouTube about sports. And that's why a lot of the audience has shifted to sports YouTube. And that's where they get their commentary on the games instead of getting it from Stephen A. Smith or whoever else.
Again, so why give a guy like Stephen A. Smith $40 million when he sees the value in YouTube to the point where, even though he's making all that money, he's like, I got to start my own YouTube channel as well. Like, it's what are you doing there, ESPN? What are you doing? Anyway, I always wrap up the show with today in history. Would you like to join me through today in history, or has this been enough for you?
No. I want to know. I'm a history nut. Let's hear it.
Beautiful. We're going to get there real quick, though. Fuji Simeon saying, hey, now the SF unicorns need to take off. Hey, Valkyries, unicorns, let's get mythical around here. Fuji, again, Stephen A. Smith will soon be more valuable than Shohei. I don't know, man. Shohei guy's pretty damn good. 50 strikeouts, 50 home runs. Not bad. ESPN investigative reporter first had the Ohtani gambling story, although she hit it big. Now the highlight is her interview with the bookie. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Fuji Simeon is literally doing everything he can to pay the mortgage and put my kids through college with the generous super chats. So thank you very, very much. It has been awesome having Ethan Sherwood Strauss with us here today. Drop the Sherwood and ready for some history. We always start history with today's birthdays. Three significant sporting entities and podcaster comedian Bobby Lee born today. Bobby Lee, 54 years old.
So funny.
He's a funny guy. Phil Jackson, 80 years old. Take all the peyote you can put in an 80-year-old man today, Phil. Congratulations, you've made it. Alex Ovechkin is 40, and Patrick Mahomes is 30 today. That's a lot of sports star power right there.
Indeed. Mahomes, that's an interesting... I mean, that's a whole other show for another day. Where is he? Are we going to be honest about it? Where are we going to reassess, or is it the team? Anyway.
Continue. Hey, I was told all you need is Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid, and you can win every Super Bowl there is. So, we'll find that out. I don't think it's that easy. Let's see. Today, in 1849, Harriet Tubman escaped from the South. She got to Maryland, and she would start the Underground Railroad. That began today in 1849, or as Donald Trump recalls, should we take that Smithsonian exhibition down? Let's get rid of that. Today in 1862, the Battle of Antietam. Oh, my God. 26,000 casualties in the Civil War. One of the bloodiest days. Maybe a turning point in the Civil War. Thoughts on Antietam? do you watch?
I don't watch the Ken Burns. Yeah. I don't watch the Ken Burns documentaries, but I should. I mean, the craziest thing. All right, I'm just going to say things that aren't profound start talking about it. But I was just saying, it feels so long ago, but when you really go back generationally, it's not that long ago. That's one of my not very profound stoner thoughts on the Civil War. It's like you're talking about within two grandpas is what you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It really, really is. Today, in 1908, Thomas Selfridge was a passenger in a plane that was piloted by Orville Wright. That plane that day crashed, killing Thomas Selfridge, becoming the first airplane fatality in human existence. There's always a first, and we know who the first airplane fatality was. Thomas Selfridge, 1908, today.
Yeah, no black box on that one.
But No. they did not. The FAA investigation was wrapped up quickly that day. Today in 1947, Jackie Robinson named the Rookie of the Year by the Sporting News. He kind of ran away with that one, I would imagine. Yep. Now, what's so sad is when you get out of like global history and you just get into American history on the websites that I go to, so much of it is just like TV shows that premiered today. Today is a prolific day in television history. Are you ready, Ethan? Because here's a script you couldn't sell. In 1965, Hogan's Heroes premiered today on CBS. Imagine walking into CBS saying, I got a half an hour sitcom that is based around the wacky antics in a Nazi concentration camp and prisoners of war. Can you believe that?
Now the existence of MASH makes more sense.
I'm glad you brought that up because the first episode of MASH aired today on CBS in 1972. I thought that the television show, as much of a hit as it was, pales in comparison to the movie, which is a masterpiece.
Oh, I mean, maybe they should go back to this sort of model, a situation comedy during the second Iraq War. It's successful.
It worked.
When they say comedy is tragedy plus time,
it's like Korea in the sand.
Yeah. Look, Netflix, you've got a lot of slop on there. You could take a chance on this. I'm into it.
Today in 1967, The Doors appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show and performed Light My Fire. Ed Sullivan requested that the lyrics, Girl, We Couldn't Get Much Higher, be changed. Jim Morrison refused to do that. The Doors were never on the Ed Sullivan Show again. As an artist, do you appreciate? I do. I'm not changing my lyrics for you, Ed. Sorry. I like that.
I mean, not those lyrics. That's not that bad. That could be interpreted a few different ways. It sounds like the Ed Sullivan Show is just being a little too, I don't know, a little too strict is what I would say.
It was a time where people were a little bit too strict. Today is the day when all the wheels started coming off modern media as we really know it. Today is the day that changed everything, Ethan. Today in 1996, the O.J. Simpson civil trial began.
Oh, my God. The civil trials what did it, not the criminal trial?
Yeah. Well, no, that's right. The civil trial was no big deal at that point, right? Yeah. But that's the moment where everything changed. Everything in media as we currently now know it was jammed through the prism of the OJ car chase
reality. Yeah. I would recommend to anybody to read Chuck Klosterman's book on the 1990s. It's so good and it's so entertaining. And there's a big chapter on what that was like at the time and how it changed everything to a degree that I wasn't really aware of because I was a kid. But yeah, anything we see now, the reality TVification, this idea of tragedy presented in a way that we laugh at outside of the sitcoms of MASH and Hogan's Heroes, just all of it and the way engagement goes, race, outrage, everything, OJ. Yeah, it was an event that shaped a lot.
When I got to KNBR and I was talking to Ralph, he would tell me, Damon, you'd be like, you missed the boat, unfortunately. Around here, you could just say Joe versus Steve. 808 KNBR, and your entire 4-hour show was done by the audience for you. And then he's like, and then we got OJ. You could just OJ Simpson, 808 KNBR, and the audience would do a 4-hour show for you.
Wasn't Ralph obsessed with OJ? Am I remembering that right? Where he also just as a litmus test of a person, they needed to admit that he did it. That's my vague memory as somebody who didn't know Ralph, but listened to the OJ that loomed. That was a great Ralph Barbieri. About
this. Thank you. I think it might be my most significant contribution to the Bay Area media. Did OJ do it? Yes, Fuji. I think he did it. It was Billy Crystal who asked the very poignant question: how many drops of another person's blood are in your car right now?
I would say that he's guilty. I think we're gonna go out there on that limb.
By the way, bang bang from Memphis, Barry Ford, Fuji Simeon, watching you. He's always they're trying to fight each other for tipping the ganja jar. But Barry, thank you very, very much. And indeed, this was a great show today. And it's not because of me. My ass is always here. It's Ethan. I mean it, man. You're state of the art. I enjoy your work more than I even tell you about how much I enjoy your work. I look forward to the Substacks when they come out. I'll even listen to you read an article. If I miss it, I'll go and podcast that bad boy. You're really good at what you do, man. Keep it up, and let's have you back on again sometime before this football season is over to talk more about the Niners.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate the coming battle between us where you try to direct me towards smart topics and I try to direct you towards whether or not the 49ers have too many tight ends. I think it will be enjoyable. I think it's just the right balance. And I appreciate all the nice things you said.
It's what the world needs. So here we are. Thank you also very much for watching today. Please, again, hit like and subscribe. Ethan, anything to plug? Any shameless plugging to do here at the end of the show?
HouseOfStrauss.com, my site. Subscribe today. Also, I'm doing non-gambling effectively, sportspredict.com, where you get to have a track record to show if you're actually good. I'm riding high right now. 75% of my NFL picks have worked out. So that's not sustainable. It's like Mac Jones. But right now I can brag about it and look like a smart guy. But everybody gets a smart rating, and you can actually, you don't have to be a fake tout. You know, these gamblers, they say, oh, I'm so good. They only show you the wins. You can't trust it. You could actually show that you're good at this and have a mind for it. So sportspredict.com. I rep that. ChatBCC, my other sponsor, and House of Strauss, the old standby. Subscribe today.
Subscribe today. Hit like and subscribe right here too, if you would. Please, thank you so very much. And please do remember that sports don't build character. They reveal it. And like that, they're gone.